The Gallic War and the Civil War by Gaius Julius Caesar. Book 1, Chapter 1. All Gaul is divided into three parts, one of which the Belgae inhabit, the Aquitani another, those who in their own language are called Celts, in ours Gauls, the third. All these differ from each other in language, customs, and laws. The river Garonne separates the Gauls from the Aquitani. The Marne and the Seine separate them from the Belgae. Of all these, the Belgae are the bravest, because they are farthest from the civilization and refinement of our province, and merchants least frequently resort to them and import those things which tend to effeminate the mind. And they are the nearest to the Germans, who dwell beyond the Rhine, with whom they are continually waging war. For which reason, the Helvetii also surpass the rest of the Gauls in valor, as they contend with the Germans in almost daily battles, when they either repel them from their own territories, or themselves wage war on their frontiers. One part of these, which it has been said that the Gauls occupy, takes its beginning at the river Rhone. It is bounded by the river Garonne, the ocean, and the territories of the Belgae. It borders, too, on the side of the Sequani and the Helvetii, upon the river Rhine, and stretches towards the north. The Belgae rise from the extreme frontier of Gaul, extend to the lower part of the river Rhine, and look towards the north and the rising sun. Aquitania extends from the river Garonne to the Pyrenean Mountains and to that part of the ocean which is near Spain. It looks between the setting of the sun and the North Star. Chapter 2. Among the Helvetii, Orgetorix was by far the most distinguished and wealthy. He, when Marcus Messalia and Marcus Piso were consuls, incited by lust of sovereignty, formed a conspiracy among the nobility, and persuaded the people to go forth from their territories with all their possessions, saying that it would be very easy, since they excelled all in valor, to acquire the supremacy of the whole of Gaul. To this he the more easily persuaded them, because the Helvetii are confined on every side by the nature of their situation. On one side by the Rhine, a very broad and deep river, which separates the Helvetian territory from the Germans. On a second side by the Jura, a very high mountain which is situated between the Sequani and the Helvetii. On a third by the Lake of Geneva, and by the River Rhone, which separates our province from the Helvetii. From these circumstances it resulted that they could range less widely, and could less easily make war upon their neighbors, for which reason men fond of war, as they were affected with great regret. They thought that considering the extent of their population, and their renown for warfare and bravery, that they had but narrow limits, although they extended in length 240 and in breadth 180 Roman miles. Chapter 3. Induced by these considerations and influenced by the authority of Orgetorix, they determined to provide such things as were necessary for their expedition, to buy up as great a number as possible of beasts of burden and wagons, to make their sowings as large as possible so that on their march plenty of corn might be in store, and to establish peace and friendship with the neighboring states. They reckoned that a term of 2 years would be sufficient for them to execute their designs. They fix by decree their departure for the third year. Orgetorix is chosen to complete these arrangements. He took upon himself the office of ambassador of the states. On this journey he persuades Casticus, the son of Catamantalades, one of the Sequani, whose father had possessed the sovereignty among the people for many years, and had been styled friend by the senate of the Roman people, to seize upon the sovereignty in his own state, which his father had held before him, and he likewise persuades Domnorix, an Aeduan, the brother of Divitiacus, who at the time possessed the chief authority in the state, and was exceedingly beloved by the people, to attempt the same, and gives him his daughter in marriage. He proves to them that to accomplish their attempts was a thing very easy to be done, because he himself would obtain the government of his own state, that there was no doubt that the Helvetii were the most powerful of the whole of Gaul. He assures them that he will, with his own forces and his own army, acquire the sovereignty for them. Incited by this speech, they give a pledge and oath to one another, and hope that when they have seized the sovereignty, they will, by means of the three most powerful and valiant nations, be enabled to obtain possession of the whole of Gaul. Chapter 4. When this scheme was disclosed to the Helvetii by informers, they, according to their custom, compelled Orgetorix to plead his cause in chains. It was the law that the penalty of being burned by fire should await him if condemned. On the day appointed for the pleading of his cause, Orgetorix drew together from all quarters to the court all his vassals to the number of 10,000 persons, and led together to the same place, and all his dependents and debtor bondsmen, of whom he had a great number. By means of these he rescued himself from the necessity of pleading his case. While the state, incensed at this act, was endeavoring to assert its right by arms, and the magistrates were mustering a large body of men from the country, Orgetorix died. And there is not wanting a suspicion, as the Helvetii think, of his having committed suicide. Chapter 5. After his death, the Helvetii nevertheless attempt to do that which they had resolved on, namely, to go forth from their territories. When they thought that they were at length prepared for this undertaking, they set fire to all their towns, in number about 12, to their villages about 400, and to the private buildings that remained. They burn up all the corn, except what they intend to carry with them, that after destroying the hope of return home, they might be the more ready for undertaking all dangers. They order everyone to carry forth from home for himself provisions for 3 months, ready ground. They persuade the Rauraci, and the Tulingi, and the Latobrigi, their neighbors, to adopt the same plan, and after burning down their towns and villages, to set out with them. And they admit to the party, and unite to themselves, as confederates, the Boii, who had dwelt on the other side of the Rhine, and had crossed over into the Norican territory, and assaulted Noria. Chapter 6. There were in all two routes from which they could go forth from their country. One through the Sequani, narrow and difficult, between Mount Jura and the River Rhone, by which scarcely one wagon at a time could be led. There was, moreover, a very high mountain overhanging, so that a very few might easily intercept them. The other through our province, much easier and freer from obstacles, because the Rhone flows between the boundaries of the Helvetii and those of the Allobroges, who had lately been subdued, and is in some places crossed by a ford. The furthest town of the Allobroges, and the nearest to the territories of the Helvetii, is Geneva. From this town a bridge extends to the Helvetii. They thought that they should either persuade the Allobroges, because they did not seem as yet well affected towards the Roman people, or compel them by force to allow them to pass through their territories. Having provided everything for the expedition, they appoint a day on which they should all meet on the bank of the Rhone. This day was the 5th before the calends of April, i.e. the 28th of March, in the consulship of Lucius Piso and Aulus Gabinius. B.C. 58. Chapter 7. When it was reported to Caesar that they were attempting to make their route through our province, he hastens to set out from the city, and, by as great marches as he can, proceeds to further Gaul and arrives at Geneva. He orders the whole province to furnish as great a number of soldiers as possible, as there was in all only one legion in further Gaul. He orders the bridge at Geneva to be broken down. When the Helvetii are apprised of his arrival, they send to him as ambassadors the most illustrious men of their state, in which embassy Numeus and Viridoctius held in chief place, to say that it was their intention to march through the province without doing any harm, because they had, according to their own representations, no other route, that they requested they might be allowed to do so with his consent. Caesar, inasmuch as he kept in remembrance that Lucius Cassius, the consul, had been slain, and his army routed and made to pass under the yoke by the Helvetii, did not think that their request ought to be granted. Nor was he of opinion that men of hostile disposition, if an opportunity of marching through the province were given to them, would abstain from outrage and mischief. Yet, in order that a period might intervene until the soldiers whom he had ordered to be furnished should assemble, he replied to the ambassadors that he would take time to deliberate. If they wanted anything, they might return on the day before the Ides of April, on April 12th. Chapter 8. Meanwhile, with the legion which he had with him, and the soldiers who had assembled from the province, he carries along for 19 Roman, not quite 18 English, miles, a wall, to the height of 16 feet, and a trench from the Lake of Geneva, which flows into the River Rhone, to Mount Jura, which separates the territories of the Sequani from those of the Helvetii. When that work was finished, he distributes garrisons and closely fortifies redoubts in order that he may the more easily intercept them, if they should at all attempt to cross over against his will. When the day which he had appointed with the ambassadors came and they returned to him, he says that he cannot, consistently with the custom and precedent of the Roman people, grant any one a passage through the province. And he gives them to understand that if they should attempt to use violence, he would oppose them. The Helvetii, disappointed in this hope, tried if they could force a passage, some by means of a bridge of boats and numerous rafts constructed for the purpose, others by the fords of the Rhone, where the depth of the river was least, sometimes by day, but more frequently by night. But being kept at bay by the strength of our works, and by the concourse of the soldiers, and by the missiles, they desisted from this attempt. Chapter 9. There was left one way, namely through the Sequani, by which, on account of its narrowness, they could not pass without the consent of the Sequani. As they could not of themselves prevail on them, they sent ambassadors to Domnorix the Aeduan, that through his intercession they might obtain their request from the Sequani. Domnorix, by his popularity and liberality, had great influence among the Sequani, and was friendly to the Helvetii, because out of that state he had married the daughter of Orgetorix, and, incited by lust of sovereignty, was anxious for a revolution, and wished to have as many states as possible attached to him by his kindness toward them. He therefore undertakes the affair and prevails upon the Sequani to allow the Helvetii to march through their territories, and arranges that they should give hostages to each other, the Sequani not to obstruct the Helvetii in their march, the Helvetii to pass without mischief and outrage. Chapter 10. It is again told Caesar that the Helvetii intend to march through the country of the Sequani and the Aedui into the territories of the Santones, which are not far distant from those boundaries of the Tolosates, which, viz. Tolosa, Toulouse, is a state in the province. If this took place, he saw that it would be attended with great danger to the province to have warlike men, enemies of the Roman people, bordering upon an open and very fertile tract of country. For these reasons, he appointed Titus Labienus, his lieutenant, to the command of the fortification which he had made. He himself proceeds to Italy by forced marches, and there levies two legions, and leads out from winter quarters three which were wintering around Aquileia, and with these five legions marches rapidly by the nearest route along the Alps into further Gaul. Here the Centrones and the Graioceli and the Caturiges, having taken possession of the higher parts, attempt to obstruct the army in their march. After having routed these in several battles, he arrives in the territories of the Vocontii in the further province on the seventh day from Ocalum, which is the most remote town of the hither province. Thence he leads his army into the country of the Allobroges, and from the Allobroges to the Segusiani. These people are the first beyond the province on the opposite side of the Rhone. Chapter 11. The Helvetii had by this time led their forces over through the narrow defile and the territories of the Sequani, and had arrived at the territories of the Aedui, and were ravaging their lands. The Aedui, as they could not defend themselves and their possessions against them, send ambassadors to Caesar to ask assistance, pleading that they had at all times so well deserved the Roman people that their fields ought not to have been laid waste, their children carried off into slavery, their towns stormed, almost within sight of our army. At the same time, the Ambari, the friends and kinsmen of the Aedui, apprise Kaiser that it was not easy for them, now that their fields have been devastated, to ward off the violence of the enemy from their towns. The Allobroges, likewise, who had villages and possessions on the other side of the Rhone, betake themselves in flight to Kaiser, and assure him that they had nothing remaining except the soil of their land. Kaiser, induced by these circumstances, decides that he ought not to wait until the Helvetii, after destroying all the property of his allies, should arrive among the Santonis. Chapter 12. There is a river called the Seine, which flows through the territories of the Aedui and Sequani into the Rhone with such incredible slowness that it cannot be determined by the eye in which direction it flows. This the Helvetii were crossing by rafts and boats joined together. When Kaiser was informed by spies that the Helvetii had already conveyed 3 parts of their forces across the river, but that the 4th part was left behind on this side of the Seine, he set out from the camp with 3 legions during the 3rd watch, and came up with that division which had not yet crossed the river. Attacking them, encumbered with baggage, and not expecting him, he cut to pieces a great part of them. The rest betook themselves to flight, and concealed themselves in the nearest woods. That canton which was cut down was called the Tigurine, for the whole Helvetian state is divided into 4 cantons. This single canton, having left their country, within the recollection of our fathers, had slain Lucius Cassius the consul, and had made his army pass under the yoke in B.C. 107. Thus, whether by chance or by the design of the immortal gods, that part of the Helvetian state which had brought a signal calamity upon the Roman people was the first to pay the penalty. In this, Kaiser avenged not only the public, but also his own personal wrongs, because the Tigurini had slain Lucius Piso, the lieutenant of Cassius, the grandfather of Lucius Calpurnius Piso, Kaiser's father-in-law, in the same battle as Cassius himself. Chapter 13. This battle ended, that he might be able to come up with the remaining forces of the Helvetii. He procures a bridge to be made across the Seine, and thus leads his army over. The Helvetii, confused by his sudden arrival, when they found that he had effected in 1 day what they themselves had with the utmost difficulty accomplished in 20, namely the crossing of the river, send ambassadors to him, at the head of which embassy was Divico, who had been commander of the Helvetii in the war against Cassius. He thus treats with Kaiser, that if the Roman people would make peace with the Helvetii, they would go to that part and there remain, where Kaiser might appoint and desire them to be. But if he should persist in persecuting them with war, that he ought to remember both the ancient disgrace of the Roman people and the characteristic valor of the Helvetii. As to his having attacked 1 canton by surprise, at a time when those who had crossed the river could not bring assistance to their friends, that he ought not on that account to ascribe very much to his own valor, or despise them that they had so learned from their sires and ancestors as to rely more on valor than on artifice or stratagem. Wherefore let him not bring it to pass that the place where they were standing should acquire a name, from the disaster of the Roman people and the destruction of their army, or transmit the remembrance of such an event to posterity. Chapter 14. To these words Kaiser thus replied, that on that very account he felt less hesitation, because he kept in remembrance those circumstances which the Helvetian ambassadors had mentioned, and that he felt the more indignant at them, in proportion as they had happened undeservedly to the Roman people. For if they had been conscious of having done any wrong, it would not have been difficult to be on their guard. But for that very reason had they been deceived, because neither were they aware that any offense had been given by them on account of which they should be afraid, nor did they think that they ought to be afraid without cause. But even if he were willing to forget their former outrage, could he also lay aside the remembrance of the late wrongs, in that they had against his will attempted a rout through the province by force? In that they had molested the Aedui, the Ambari, and the Allobroges? That as to their so insolently boasting of their victory, and as to their being astonished that they had so long committed their outrages with impunity, both these things tended to the same point. For the immortal gods are wont to allow those persons whom they wish to punish for their guilt sometimes a greater prosperity and longer impunity, in order that they may suffer the more severely from a reverse of circumstances. Although these things are so, yet if hostages were to be given him by them in order that he may be assured they will do what they promise, and provided they will give satisfaction to the Aedui for the outrages which they had committed against them and their allies, and likewise to the Allobroges, he, Caesar, will make peace with them. Divico replied that the Helvetii had been so trained by their ancestors that they were accustomed to receive, not to give, hostages. Of that fact the Roman people were witness. Having given his reply, he withdrew. Chapter 15. On the following day they move their camp from that place. Caesar does the same, and sends forward all his cavalry to the number of 4,000, which he had drawn together from all parts of the province and from the Aedui and their allies, to observe towards what parts the enemy are directing their march. These, having too eagerly pursued the enemy's rear, come to a battle with the cavalry of the Helvetii in a disadvantaged place, and a few of our men fall. The Helvetii, elated with this battle because they had with 500 horse repulsed so large a body of horse, began to face us more boldly, sometimes too from their rear to provoke our men by an attack. Caesar, however, restrained his men from battle, deeming it sufficient from the present to prevent the enemy from rapine, forage, and depredation. They marched for about 15 days in such a manner that there was not more than 5 or 6 miles between the enemy's rear and our van.